It's now time for the Fantasy 411 podcast.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Fantasy 411. I'm Matthew Leach, talking fantasy baseball with MLB.com's lead fantasy writer, Fred Zinke. Fred, how you doing?
I'm terrific. I'm enjoying these spring training games and getting close to Tout Wars, so I'm starting to get a little nervous and a little excited all at the same time.
Outstanding. We are well into the season here in North Georgia. They are well into the season in the big league games down in Florida and Arizona. And, one of the things, unfortunately, that means is that people are starting to get hurt. So a lot of what we have to talk about right now is injuries. We also have a couple of transactions. A guy I have liked for a long time and who in recent years has not reciprocated that is Austin Jackson. He's now with the White Sox. I'm just kind of not sure how any of that shakes out. I mean, aside from Adam Eaton, do you like Austin Jackson? Do you like Avisail Garcia? It kind of takes some guys I wasn't crazy about and makes them even less interesting. Is there anybody from that bunch that kind of jumps out to you?
Yeah, it's a hard one to get a read on. My gut on it is that Melky Cabrera clears the whole thing and continues to play pretty much every day. And I think Adam Eaton plays pretty much every day, although Eaton's pretty injury-prone, so I could see maybe the White Sox thinking, okay, we'll give him a little more rest throughout the season, which may not be a bad thing. Beyond that, though, I feel like this logjam just kind of rules out maybe Jackson and Garcia in mixed leagues, except for deeper mixed leagues, because, I don't know, I could just kind of see that rotating situation between center field, right field, and DH, and I think it pushes Adam LaRoche probably all the way down to AL only.
I kept waiting for Garcia, and look, he's intriguing to me because even now, he's playing this year at age 25, and at various points he has shown some skills. He hit 13 homers last year. He has hit for average at times in partial seasons, and yet he gets a chance to play just about full time, and it just didn't happen at all. Have you given up on Garcia, or do you still see something alike there, if not immediately, in the sort of medium term?
Yeah, I guess I haven't given up on him. I'm surprised. I was surprised all offseason that the White Sox were consistently rumored to be in the market for an outfielder or a DH, but one more big slugger, because I always saw them tied to outfielders, and I thought, wait, why do they need an outfielder when they have Cabrera, Eaton, and Garcia? But this seems to be a bit of a statement by the organization that they're not sold on him as a 145, 150-game player, and, you know, they're the ones who see him up close a lot more than us. So it makes me pretty tentative on him for this year, and I guess for long term, because, you know, you want a player in a situation where his organization, especially at his age, is really promoting him.
Yeah, I don't get him, but they're such they do interesting things in the White Sox. I feel like you're probably best not even trying to figure out what they're doing sometimes. The other transaction we have this week, which has a lot, as you mentioned, with Jackson, also leads to a lot of moving parts, is Pedro Alvarez in Baltimore. In a vacuum, I really like this for Alvarez. I don't think anybody was really going to give him a huge opportunity, but if you feel like they're going to let him be who he is, they're going to let him hack away, try to, you know, hit a lot of home runs, strike out a lot, that's okay. I mean, the Orioles seem to kind of embrace the kind of hitter Alvarez is, and I don't think they would have given him the deal they gave him if they didn't expect him to play a good bit. So before we get into the ramifications, are you with me that of the various options for Alvarez, this seems like one of the better ones?
Yeah, I think this is about as good as it can get, you know, in the sense of no competition for playing time. I mean, he probably should sit against a lot of lefties, but, you know, no competition for playing time against right-handers, no need to send him out in the field, and, you know, we don't know how much he really struggled as a fielder. How much did that get into his head and affect his offensive production? So he can just relax now and hit. Like, this is a chance for him to hit 30 home runs this year.
Yeah, and I'm not sure beat writers know these things as much as we sometimes think we do. I know those of us looking at from a distance don't know these things, but there has been something of a reputation with Alvarez as a guy who really sort of gets negative, a guy who really sort of, to some extent, lets failure get to him. Again, I'm always skeptical of that stuff because I just don't think we know. But if it's true, and like you mentioned, if he can just worry about hitting and hit in a lineup where, again, nobody's really going to get down on you if you strike out. That's just kind of the way the Orioles are. They hit the ball out of the park. Now, again, Clint Hurdle is certainly also quite a positive guy, but if we're looking for little edges, I feel like maybe there's reason to think, as you note, this might be a really good fit in ways beyond just the opportunity and ballpark.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and I guess the only unknown will be how he handles not going out in the field if he has a bad week or something like that. Because some players talk about, you know, when they're just a DH and they don't go out and you know, kind of keep themselves busy and get their mind off things. You know, if he goes 0 for 4, you know, 3 or 4 days in a row and he's just sitting around, does it start, if he is a negative thinker, does that get him into a big funk or not? But, I mean, that's projecting too much. I think bottom line is, you know, we've got a home run hitter going into a home run friendly park on a team that likes guys that hit home runs. So this is a good fit.
Now, the other piece here, the guy who would seem to be most immediately affected might be Mark Trumbo, but it sounds like Trumbo's now going to play the outfield. It's not a big outfield. It's not like you're asking him to play outfield in some of the places where he's been asked to do that. He should be able to sort of handle that and not defensively play his way out of the role. My first reaction was kind of the weird fit, two really sort of bat-only guys. But the more I think about it, I think there's space for both these guys. Do you downgrade Trumbo at all, or do you still view him as the way you did a week ago?
Yeah, no, my opinion on Trumbo hasn't really changed. The Orioles have a kind of a funky lineup right now where they could have kind of Davis, Trumbo, and Alvarez in some sort of order from 4, 5, 6, so three kind of all-or-nothing swingers in a row. It's a lineup that will be really fun when it's going well, and we'll probably have some explosive games. Dexter Fowler probably would have been a better fit for this club in the sense that they don't have two good candidates, I feel like, to hit at the top of the lineup. You know, Machado can hit first or second, but they don't really have another candidate to hit in one of those two spots. I'm very interested to see who they pick to go up near the top lineup because that player could have more value than we're anticipating right now.
And that ties into something we've talked about before, but I think we should talk about one more time because it seems to be more likely. We've sort of talked about Manny Machado as maybe a leadoff guy or better yet, as a two-hitter with Fowler, which, as you note, was pretty clearly the better fit for that club, I think. But based on some lineups and based on this move, it seems clearer than ever to me that Machado may lead off for them. Does that hurt his value to you?
To me, it hurts it just a little bit. I just feel like it's, even in the American League, it's really hard to get a really high RBI total when you're hitting leadoff. I mean, we see guys who hit second, you know, we saw Josh Donaldson last year get up around the 120 mark. That's unusual, but we can see guys get up around the 100 mark in RBIs. We don't really see that with a leadoff hitter, usually 70 or 80 even in the AL for great hitters about the peak. So it caps that one category for him a little bit. And he's also, if he's hitting leadoff, assuming they don't just bump up everyone and hit Adam Jones second, then he's also hitting leadoff in front of maybe not a great fit as the number two hitter. To me, it maybe all just pushes him towards the end of the first round instead of towards the middle.
And now we move on to the unfun part of this because it is injury season, both minor and major. You know, you get guys come down with serious stuff, and you also get guys who just kind of miss a few days. The first really significant one, and this is significant in fantasy and for a major league team, Johnny Peralta is going to miss a significant chunk of time. That is a big blow to the Cardinals, who don't really have another shortstop, which is curious. I am highly skeptical that Jed Jerko gets any significant time at shortstop in reality. I know that's what they're saying now. Do you speculatively buy Jerko now, or do you still kind of wait and say, look, they're probably going to do something else?
Yeah, I'm not really excited about Jerko. Like, in a deep mixed league, maybe I'd take him in the last round if I was drafting this weekend or something and just kind of see how it shakes out. My guess is that the Cardinals will kind of take a look at him at shortstop in the next couple of weeks and then evaluate their options. I don't really love the other options on the roster. That being said, it's a resourceful organization, and there will be players around the league, you know, who don't really have a good fit by the end of spring training, and maybe they can pick up a stopgap cheap. So I feel like there's a decent chance that the Cardinals' main shortstop for the first half of the year isn't in the organization right now. Do you think that's a possibility?
Yeah, well, I think there's another interesting name, and I don't know how interesting he is for fantasy, but I think I wouldn't speculatively pick him up until he's actually on the roster and playing. But Diaz, the Cuban shortstop, really has hit some in the minors. Last year, he hit for a little power, 13 home runs combined at Double A and Triple A. Guy they liked coming out of Cuba. He turns 26 this year. I don't know. I'll believe they give him the job when I see it, but that's a guy that kind of intrigues me if he gets the opportunity. Again, I'm not jumping on Aledmys Diaz without knowing he's a shortstop. But if he's the Cardinals shortstop, I think he's an interesting late-round name. Are you buying it all, or are you completely hands-off even if he gets a job?
No, I would. If he got the job, I would buy an NL only. I'd maybe watch like in a 15-team mixed league and just see maybe how he started the season. You could probably afford to do that because the Cardinals are kind of a pitching first organization in my mind. You know, it's true that they might just go through spring training and look for the person who fields the shortstop position really well and then deal with the off. It's not like Peralta's a solid offensive player, but it's not like he was the cog driving the lineup. So maybe they just take the guy who they feel like is going to field the position really well. And I think both of us are kind of hinting that we don't think that's Jericho.
Yeah, and look, the other thing, if there's one thing I learned from 10 years around that organization, and it's a lot of the same people I covered, it's that whatever they do, we are almost certainly not going to see it coming. There are a lot of organizations that have leaks, a lot of clubs where you hear rumblings and that's what's going to happen. Cardinals, more than nearly any other club in baseball, when they do something, you don't see it coming. They're really good at that, so we can speculate, but I'm also pretty confident in saying that there's a real good chance they're going to do something we did not see coming.
Yeah, absolutely, and a lot of people will talk about how fantasy baseball is a bit of a zero-sum game where one guy loses value and then another guy picks up value, but that's not always true. I mean, this is a move where we see that a really weak, already weak shortstop pool got further depleted with the loss of Peralta for the first half of the year, and there may not be a replacement for him. So this one isn't a zero sum where you lose Peralta, but you just plug in someone else who can help you. Again, like shortstop's at a little more of a premium now than it was a week ago.
For sure, for sure. So that's an interesting question then. Does that broadly affect your draft day strategy at shortstop?
I'd say not at this point, like not one Peralta, but it could add up. For example, last year I felt like we had a really good kind of first and second tier of starting pitchers, and then we saw Zach Wheeler, Marcus Stroman, Yu Darvish, like we saw these pitchers, Alex Cobb, all go down. Those guys were all in the top, say, 25 to 30 starting pitchers during spring training. So I think like just Peralta wouldn't be enough, but shortstop being thinner than starting pitcher, if we saw a couple other shortstops go down during spring training, then that would maybe change my strategy.
Moving on down the unfortunate injuries list, the Marlins, and we've talked a good bit about the situation, so I don't want to spend too long on it, but the Marlins will do without Carter Capps for the season. He's having surgery. That's a very big blow for them. But it also takes out a guy, one of the very few guys that you would draft even if you didn't know he was going to get saves. I wonder, does it affect your rating on Ramos at all? Does it give you a little more confidence? My personal feeling is he's a later guy anyway because he's not that dominant guy, so I'm not sure I would have been beaten down the door for him anyway. It doesn't really change my view. Does it bump him up in value at all to you?
To me, it does. I kind of view him as one of those kind of second-tier closers. Like, he's a little wild, but now he's, like, pretty much unchallenged for save chances. Like, I feel like he'd have to have a really bad run. He's not, I guess, I don't think he's a top-10 closer, but there's a lot of unsettled bullpens out there, and, you know, he's got a secure role now. So I think he's in that middle group of 10 where, you know, like he's not your maybe relief pitcher anchor like Craig Kimbrell is, but, you know, you're a lot better off with him than with Drew Storen, for example, right now, who we don't know if he's going to be the closer or not.
Here's my question on the Marlins, though. I think they've made it pretty clear that they're not a team that is going to stick with a guy through absolutely anything. I think well, of course, it's a new manager now, so I may be wrong on that. But even Don Mattingly, you know, I'm not sure that the absence of Caps necessarily means that Ramos is the guy through thick and thin. I think it means he's clearly the guy coming out of spring training. But it still wouldn't shock me to see them find somebody else they really liked halfway through the season or see Ramos have a rough couple of weeks and see them look at other options.
Yeah, and my concern with Ramos, actually, but we talked about the Marlins a little bit, I think it was last week, is my concern with them not being in the race and then exploring the trade market with him, just that whole theory, like with Ken Giles last year, right? That whole theory of, you know, if you're not playing winning baseball, you don't really need a closer if you can trade him for something that helps you long term. I think that's something that we need to think about, not really with Ramos and the Marlins, in the sense that I think they're a little too good for that, especially when we really started to break down the top half of their lineup. But closers on the lesser teams, that's a concern for me. Like Ramos, I feel like you can see a window there, a path for him if he pitches well to get 35 saves. Whereas on some of the lower teams, I'm worried that, let's take like Jason Grilley. I feel like Jason Grilley either pitches poorly and you don't want him, or he pitches well and then the Braves almost certainly move him in July, at which point you only get about half a season out of him anyways. Ramos, I can see a possibility of a full season as a closer.
And this actually leads into another guy that I apologize. This was not something we discussed beforehand, but another guy I think is worth mentioning that very much fits in that category. David Hernandez is dealing with what seems to be a minor injury, but he's also not pitching yet. What do you do with the Phillies right now? Is there anybody in that bullpen that you really like, or do you just wait it out and see whether it's Hernandez or somebody else that takes that job?
Yeah, 10 or 12 team mixed league, I'll just pass on the entire bullpen. You know, 15 team league, I would take Hernandez, you know, as a bench player or late in the draft and, you know, for a dollar kind of guy and just see what happens. But it comes back to one of my theories, which is, you know, if I'm going to take the risk, then I want to know what the upside is. And the upside on Hernandez is the closer on one of probably the two or three worst teams in baseball. And while he could get some saves for sure, the obstacles now for him to be really mixed league relevant are starting to pile up, in the sense of, you know, he's injured, you know, he hasn't pitched a lot in recent seasons, and he's injured. He's on a team that doesn't look like they're going to generate a lot of save chances. It might be a chance, you know, for someone else to jump up and steal that job. Like, they've got a lot of relievers in there on minor league deals.
A guy I like a lot that I was sad just from a sort of a personal level to see get hurt, and a guy I really like watch playing, and a guy I thought was maybe due for another nice year. Those who listen to MLB.com extras last year know I was a big Cameron Maven backer. He's going to be gone for a while. Are you buying Anthony Ghosh, or are you skeptical of him?
I'm pretty skeptical. You know, cheap speed and AL only for sure. In a mixed league, I think I would pass. This could create, and you know, you said you're a bit of a believer in Maven. Like, this can create a nice discount for Maven. This is different than Peralta. We're not talking about someone who's going to be out till the All-Star break. We're talking about someone who can be back in April. So if no one in your league wants Maven, you know, you can stash him in your bench or DL spot for a couple weeks, and maybe you'll have a useful outfielder after that.
What do you think is the real Maven? The first half guy last year, the second half guy last year, the total of 2015? What do you think the actual player is?
Yeah, maybe the total of 2015. I don't think it's the first half guy. He hit so many ground balls that I just don't see him contributing power. So his kind of thing, I guess, is that you hope that he hits 275 or something and then steals bases. It doesn't look like the Tigers are going to hit him high in the lineup. I was initially hoping that was going to happen, but, you know, and he could kind of be like that ground ball heavy, fast base runner, table setter kind of guy. It doesn't seem like that's going to happen. I think that takes him out of standard mixed leagues and kind of pushes him to deep mixed leagues. Do you see a scenario where he could maybe hit 300 or something like that?
I just don't know. He's one of those guys, to me, what I like about Maben is at various points he's done nearly everything. I mean, he's never hit for a real high average, but he's hit 270-ish. He's shown a little bit of power at times. He's stolen bases. He has at times shown an idea of the strike zone. He's 29 this year. He's not as young as I like to think. But I just kind of feel like he's a guy who, in any given year, one of these years, I just can see him putting a lot of things together. He hasn't done it, and if somebody's skeptical, I certainly won't tell them they're wrong. But I just feel like he's a guy who his upside is somebody who contributes in a lot of ways.
Yeah, no, I can definitely see that. And like I said, if someone wants to find bench spot, DL spot for him, like, it's not a bad idea. He could be back, you know, 2 weeks into the season.
Yeah. We move on down, and we now take a look at the MLB.com top fantasy prospects story. That is now up on MLB.com. From Jim Callis, and it's different, and this is interesting for Kalish because, of course, he is a prospect expert, and his field of expertise is prospects generally. But this is really about guys who are going to make an impact in 2016. We've talked a lot about Corey Seager. Everybody loves Corey Seager. He's not a guy that we necessarily need to spend a lot of time talking about. It's not really a secret. The guy that I thought was interesting on that list was Byron Buxton, who it's weird. I mean, he is still one of the top prospects in the game, and yet he almost is already starting to have a little bit of that, like, post-hype sleeper feel to him. But this guy has hit everywhere he's been. He's an enormous talent. He is a guy who can do a lot of different things. What do you do with Buxton coming into 2016? Because he's a hard guy to figure.
He is, and I think we've been spoiled maybe, especially last year, but in recent years with top prospects coming up and really hitting the ground running. So then when he didn't, I think maybe fantasy owners are too quick to just cast him aside and say, oh, this guy was, you know, he's all hype and isn't really the real deal. Well, he's still very young, and you know, Jim reminds us he's still very talented and one of the best prospects in the game. So I'm not going to go crazy on his projection, but you know, Jim's endorsement does mean something to me. He's as plugged into minor leaguers as anyone. And, you know, he talks about an upside with Buxton of maybe 15 homers and something like 25 steals. So if you don't want to go that high, you know, if he can hit double-digit homers, get in the 20s for steals, I'd love to see him near the top of their lineup and see what he can do with his speed. And I don't think he'll be there on opening day, which maybe makes him a bench option in a smaller league, a 10 or 12 team. But maybe throughout the season, if he's playing well, he gets up near the top of the lineup, and now we're really on to something.
The question for me with Buxton is the power, and it's he hits a lot of doubles and triples, and triples are sort of an outlier, but I sort of feel like, to some extent, that may the old adage about doubles turning into homers may apply to triples as well for a speed guy like that, because I think a lot of those triples are doubles for other people. I'm not sure what to make of the power. I can see him down the line being a 20-home-run guy, but I'm not sure I see it now. How do you kind of evaluate home-run power on a guy like this who's this young and still kind of coming into his strength?
Yeah, I think you're right. I don't think you can project the big jump at his age right now. And you're right, some of those doubles and triples, as he gets a little older, fills out a little bit, you know, more time on the weights and everything, it starts near his prime. Maybe then he's a 20-homer player. But this year, you know, like I said, I'm hoping for double digits. And once you kind of cap him around 10 or 12 homers, then you're like, then it's hard to justify him like really early or even in the middle rounds of a regular mixed league draft. Like, now I'll go back to Dexter Fowler again, but if you want to compare, say, players like that, like, you should get more homers or as many homers out of Fowler. You might not get quite as many steals, but you get him hitting at the top of a good lineup, and then you get Buxton hitting at the bottom of a lineup. And to me, that makes like a big difference. So I feel like he needs to be kind of behind those veterans like Fowler, who, sure, they don't carry that elite prospect status and get all the comments about them, but they're just more reliable fantasy producers. I feel like Buxton's probably going to be overdrafted in a lot of leagues just because of his prospect status, and I just don't see him maybe getting there this year.
The one thing I would wonder about that, though, is I think we know what Fowler, for example, and I think Fowler's an interesting parallel and kind of a good test case. I think we, if nothing else, we know what Fowler's ceiling is. We know there are certain things he's not going to do. Buxton's ceiling, we don't know. It's less than a 10% chance that Buxton just goes bonkers on the league this year. But it's more than 0%. And so I wonder, how do you factor that in, that I don't know if it's a 2 or a 5 or an 8% chance that he just goes nuts. He does come into his power because he is such an amazing talent. He is such the ceiling ultimately is so high, and we see more and more guys hit their ceiling sooner. How do you account for that possibility, even if it's small, that unlike somebody like Fowler, it wouldn't be utterly shocking if Buxton just went nuts this year?
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, I think you account for that by building it into your projections. So if I'm projecting out his stats, I'll project him out to what I think he's going to do this year. And then given that, like you said, he has that maybe 10% chance that he explodes this year. So because of that, I'll tack on, you know, I'll get a little optimistic now. I'll tack on a couple homers, a couple more steals, a few more runs. You know, I'll boost that. Whereas for someone like Fowler, I'm just going to project what I think he's going to do this year, and then that's it. Because there's not that breakout potential. I think that's the best way to do it. You can't really draft him based on the big breakout, but you have to acknowledge it a little bit, and then you just see. So project what you think he's going to do, give him little bumps kind of across the board, and then see how he compares to other players like Fowler, who are similar profiles, you know, a little five category producer, and kind of see, you know, how he compares to those guys. I think that's the most sensible way to do it. It's hard to, because then you take some of the bias of the prospect label off of him when you're ranking him.
One other name on that list that I am intrigued by, a guy I really like in the sort of even medium term, but I'm not crazy about in the short term. We have Trey Turner as the number four prospect for fantasy this year. Maybe Dusty Baker decides he loves that speed. It wouldn't be unheard of. But everything I hear is that the Nationals really intend for Danny Espinosa to be their shortstop and obviously they're set at second base, they're set at third, assuming that Murphy and Rendon stay healthy. I just don't see the path for Turner, unless Espinosa's just terrible, I don't see the path for Turner to be that impact guy this year. Do you see it there, or are you kind of with me that loving Turner as a player, but just not sure on the opportunity?
Yeah, drafting Turner is mostly about your feelings on Espinosa. So the path for him is Espinosa suffers a long-term injury, or Espinosa is hitting, you know, 197 or 210 or something at the end of May, and they say, the Nats should be a competitive team, and they say, we can't live with this anymore, you know, and Turner's tearing it up in the minors, and they bring him up. So I feel like Turner's promotion will be a little bit to do with Turner. I mean, he has to do his job and hit in the minors at the start of the year, but maybe more to do with Espinosa, because Espinosa is a fairly flawed player. I can see the possibility. I got hit with a good question on Twitter the other day, and someone asked me if I would rather have Turner or Peraza for this season. Who would you rather have?
I'd probably still rather have Turner, but that's more about the players to me. I have one of those illogical things. I'm just not a Peraza guy. I'm just not a buyer, and I understand that he's very fast. I understand that. I just can't get paid. He's one of the things we've talked about. He's just one of those guys I just kind of don't buy. And so if I, you know, inherited a score sheet team or something that had him on it, I wouldn't be like I was trying to get rid of him. But he's not a guy. I think there's more in Turner, and so even with the limited opportunity, I think I like the upside on Turner more.
Yeah, and Turner's someone who's going to go all or nothing, right? Like, he's either going to be in the minors or he's going to be the Nats starting shortstop at some point. Peraza, I think, is going to have an interesting season in that I feel pretty optimistic he's going to be on the Reds to start the year, and then is going to kind of float around, and we'll see if he gets two starts a week or five starts a week. And then, but they're past the long-term, like, you know, regular mixed league value is they're both in the same situation that they probably need a veteran to suffer a long-term injury this year for them to get in that regular spot. I guess Peraza has a few more spots he could fit into since they're kind of working him out at other positions too. But yeah, I find the two of them good comparisons this year, and I feel like they're both just right on the verge of breaking through, and they just need their organization to give them a shot. And then because Turner's has a good skill set overall, and because Peraza has the speed, they're both really interesting.
Yeah, and I think that the difference for me is in the end, sometimes it's just, we talk a lot about opportunity and all these kind of things. I just like the player better. I just like the player better in Turner. I'm also biased. I loved him as a college player. I acknowledge that. But I can see Trey Turner as an all-star major league player, and I can't see Jose Peraza being that. And I don't think either of the guys is that this year, but I just really like what I think Turner can be a lot more.
Yeah, no, I totally understand that. And, you know, we have a draft tips article coming out next week, and one of the tips in it is draft players you believe in, and especially don't draft players that you don't believe in, because, you know, that's, you may trade them, but in general, that's a 6-month relationship with that player. And when they're going good or going bad, you want to know that it started with you drafting players you believe in.
I'm going to touch briefly, and we have, as usual, gone very slowly because we've got a lot to talk about. We're going to touch briefly on the Fantasy 411 Expert Slow Mock Draft at fantasy411.mlblogs.com. A lot of names of some real experts, including some dude named Fred Zinke. Also including our own Corey Schwartz, Nando DeFino, a whole bunch of people who, if you know anything about fantasy, you know the names. From having done this Did it help you with anything? Did it show you anything? Did anything jump out about this particular experience for you?
Like, probably not for me because I work in the industry and I'm basically thinking about fantasy baseball all day every day. Like, we had a pretty good understanding of where the players were going to go ahead of the draft. There's always some surprises in any individual draft, but I think for a lot of people who will read the draft results and read the commentary up at the site, like, and there's a video to go along with it, I think it starts to give you a better impression of where certain players are slotting into drafts this year. And then some of the owners who maybe take someone a little out of the box, a little too high for what other people are doing, but in this mock, you get the explanation from them, two or three sentences for them to say why they did it, and then that can open your eyes maybe to a player. So I think mock drafts, I don't think they're the be-all and end-all, but I think reading mock draft results is a good way to get ready for your draft. You know, it takes us hours and hours and hours to do the mock. Readers get to go in just a few minutes or an hour or something they can spend on a mock and really play it out and see who they would have ended up with to get them ready for the real draft.
I find it, and I don't mock draft in baseball that much, only because, like you, I'm sort of baseball up to my eyes at all times. I do mock in football some, and the only reason I bring that up is that one of the things I've taken from it, and I wonder kind of what you think about this, is I feel like and I think you make a good point about reading them, I think doing a single mock has very little value. I don't want to do hours and hours of them, but if I do football, I'll do maybe three, and then you sort of get a feel for if this happens, then this happens, and that, I think, is where you start getting the value. The value in doing a mock to me is not seeing the top five picks. It's seeing, okay, if I take this guy four, and in football it's if I take the tight end at eight or whatever it is, if I take Kershaw four, where does that leave me three rounds from now if I didn't get a big bat there? I don't know how much you do mocks, but to me that's the value, is you do it once, you don't really get anything. If you do a couple of them, then you start seeing how those sequences work out when you make certain decisions.
Yeah, for sure, and I often say you can build your fantasy baseball team from the bottom up. So if you look at a lot of mocks, and let's say there's a player you're really into, maybe it's Trey Turner, but there's a player it wouldn't be him, probably he's going to start the year in the minors, but, you know, let's say it's Buxton, and you really want to build, like, you want him to be part of your team. If you look at a lot of mocks, you can get a pretty good idea of where you need to go to get that player. Also, if you look at a lot of mocks, let's say there's a catcher you really like, and you say, that guy, I'm going to get him late. He's going to be my catcher. You can get a good idea of where you're going to need to take him. And if you like that value, then you know in the early rounds, okay, I can pass on Posey. I can pass on Schwarber because I'm waiting for my guy. Maybe it's Real Muto, but I know from all these mocks that I can get Real Muto in round 18, and I love it. You can build your team from the bottom up if you've prepared yourself from looking at mock drafts.
I like that a lot. And then finally we get to the starting pitcher preview, which is part one is – we can almost ignore it. We can almost just go to part two and say, you know who number one is. Tier one all alone is Clayton Kershaw.
Don't even
Kershaw.
Need to say his name.
We have talked a lot about him. The only question is how high do you take him? Do you take him as high as three or four? We've even talked about that a good bit. So I want to move on to tier two because I think that's where the interesting questions come in, because pretty much every guy on this list, with maybe one or two exceptions, has some slight ding, has some reason that you maybe worry, and so it's a question of which of those worries bothers you the least and which of the upsides you like the most. The names, I'm just going to read them all, and I apologize if people's eyes glaze over here. Arrieta, Scherzer, Sale, Bumgarner, Harvey, Price, Cole, Greinke, DeGrom, Keuchel, Kluber, Fernandez, Strasburg. The first thing that comes to mind is, holy cow, is that a lot of really good starting pitchers and really good fantasy starting pitchers. The second is there really is kind of a matter of taste here. I mean, you've got guys who are going to put up ridiculous rates and you don't know how much of it, somebody like Harvey. You've got guys that you're really confident are going to pitch a lot of innings, but maybe you're not so crazy about the rates. Price is a guy that comes to mind in that category. As you look at this group of guys, do you draft them in relation to each other? Do you think maybe I want two of these guys? How do you, just as far as mental framework, as far as your approach to that group, how do you approach them on draft day?
Yeah, I think you have to have one. I mean, there's so many good pitchers out there now, you can't afford to ignore them. I think you have to have one. I think it's okay to get two from that group A lot of it might depend on where you're picking in your draft. If you're near one end or the other, you know, you might decide to get two, or you might press a little earlier at least to get your first one because you might be afraid of a run, which I've seen in a lot of drafts so far this year, a big run. Because those guys are so similar, you can see 10 of those guys or 12 of those guys going in the span of like 17 picks, and you could get left out if you're on the end. If you're in the middle of your draft, though, because that group's so deep, it might create a nice opportunity, if you don't mind not having your choice, of just saying, I'm going to kind of let this group dwindle, and then when the first time it hits me and there's, you know, say three or four of them left, then I'll grab my favorite one out of the one that's left. Because, like you said, there's a reason to dislike all of those pitchers, but there's a lot of reasons to like all of them. So I think it just depends if you have your heart set on one or if you kind of see the bright side of most of them and you'd be happy with just about anyone on the list.
We talked about this last week, or 2 weeks ago maybe, with Bumgarner. Of those guys, who do you think is the highest floor? Is it Bumgarner? Is it Scherzer? Who's the guy out of that whole group that if you say, I get him, I know every pitcher is unpredictable, but I'm going to worry the least about him?
Yeah, I guess the highest floor to me would probably, well, Price is up there for high floor and Bumgarner, but to me it might be Scherzer and Arrieta. In the sense of with Scherzer, you know you're going to get the strikeouts. So even if the ratios aren't quite what you wanted, like he'll have a K per nine over 10. It's almost guaranteed. And then with Arrieta, I know he hasn't been an ace for as long as guys like Bumgarner and Price, but like he's been pretty awesome for the last 2 years. And I mean awesome. Like he's been pitching on another level basically for all the last two seasons. So even with some regression, you know, I feel like his floor is really high right now. But out of that group, those are kind of the names to me, Arrieta, Scherzer, Price, Bumgarner, that have the really high floor where, you know, barring a significant injury, I just can't see them not having a good year.
And then who worries you most, not in terms of just absolute blow-up risk, because, again, guys get hurt, but as far as maybe having that worrisome fall from being in this group to being where Felix was last year to kind of where Lester is, the guy you're least confident stays, even if he's healthy, in that tier?
Yeah, I guess if they're all healthy, I guess probably Keuchel's the one that worries me the most just because he made that really big jump last year and he doesn't have the monster strikeout rate of some of the other guys, so he needs to have the really low ratios. So, you know, if he starts having a 3.1 ERA and a 1.15 whip, now with his strikeout rate, you know, being in the sevens, probably maybe eight at the most, like he's not even close to that tier anymore. That being said, I feel really good about Keuchel that he will continue to be a workhorse this year and be really good. I drafted him as my ace in labor, you know, kind of after most of these guys were gone. But I feel good about him, but he's the one I can see falling off. To me, it's the injury risk with a lot of them that concerns me more in the sense of Strasburg, Fernandez, you know, maybe Harvey, re-injury, something like that. But it's the injury risk that makes me worried about some of them. Again, there's not much to choose from here. Like, they're all really, really good players.
We move to Tier 3, which contains some of my favorite pitchers. So a couple guys I want to talk about. Carrasco, Lester, Archer, Gray, Syndergaard, Cueto, Felix Hernandez. I am just a shameless Chris Archer honk. I know he faded some after a ridiculous start last year, but he's a guy that I'm going to kind of bet on a little bit and think he's got a really good shot of jumping up into that next level. Syndergaard, another guy, I think it's ludicrous. I think he may have the best pure stuff of any starter in the game. Either of those guys worry you? Either of those guys you're not as on board with as I am?
No, I'm on board with both of those guys. I'll say this, that Archer, I think, may have, of all the ace types, and he's borderline, you know, second tier, of all those ace types, he may have the hardest road to hoe through the season of anyone, in the sense of his four other teams in his division all are really tough matchups, right? The Blue Jays, best offense in baseball last year, the Yankees and the Red Sox, both in the top five, and we just talked about how the Orioles are lining up a pretty impressive group of mashers, even if they will strike out a lot, you know, which is good for your starting pitcher, but those are tough matchups for him. It might be hard for him to have in that division to have like a really, really special season, whereas someone like Syndergaard, or if we look at other guys in the NL in that tier, like someone like Lester, who's pitching on maybe the best team in a National League that has six teams probably that are really rebuilding right now. So I love Archer. I would love Archer a lot more if I didn't see that schedule looming for him with a lot of really hard divisional games.
Is there anything short of just only having done it for two-thirds of a season? Is there anything besides that that holds you back on Syndergaard? To me, that's the only thing. Again, I'm a shameless Syndergaard honk. I love watching him pitch. I love his stuff. To me, the only thing that holds me back on him is just he's only done it for 4 months.
Yeah, for sure. And it would be the concern maybe that the Mets hold him back from an innings perspective a little bit, and maybe he tops out at 185 or something this year and doesn't get up. When we start looking at, you know, someone like Lester who will give you 200 from that tier, and I think Archer's going to be ready to handle a heavy workload this year. If you look at the common theme with a few of those guys, though, like Sonny Gray from that tier, same thing. Like, he was great for 5 months last year and then not good in September, so my concern with him is his ability to handle a heavy workload and be good all season. Syndergaard, I think, is going to be awesome. Will the Mets, especially if they're en route to the postseason again, which with that rotation it looks like they should be, are they going to kind of hold him back throughout the year to make sure they save him for October? It's a minor concern, but especially with someone who's strikeout-based like him, it does all add up. Is he your favorite? Would Archer or Syndergaard be your favorite from that tier?
I probably Syndergaard for me, just because I can't get over how ridiculous he is when he's good. And look, he's still going to have some command issues sometimes, and there will be days he's not there. But I think that guy's best game is quite possibly the best game anybody can throw currently, except maybe Kershaw or Scherzer. His what he can get to for me is ludicrous and is higher than even a guy like Archer, who I also love.
Yeah, for sure. And he was a little homer prone at times last year. He's someone who's, I think you're right, I think he's on the verge of figuring it all out. I think we both probably expect him to be in tier two of this, you know, list next year.
I absolutely do, yeah. That's how I would put that, is I will be surprised if he's not there. We are once again running long. We will touch on 4 and 5 because there are some interesting names in there. Tier four, Danny Salazar, Garrett Richards, Tyson Ross, Cole Hamels, Adam Wainwright. I wrote something for Sports on Earth recently, spring training predictions, and one was that by the end of spring, people would be talking about Adam Wainwright as a Cy Young contender, because just I figured he'd have something to prove. He's been really good. I really like Wainwright, and I would love to get him as something of a bargain. Do you think he will be able to be gotten as a bargain, or do you think the name means he's still going to go pretty high?
Yeah, he's quickly coming back to going pretty high. I've noticed in recent drafts he's starting to go pretty high. Like, people are, as soon as he took to the mound again, people remember, okay, yeah, this is Adam Wainwright. He's a starter again. He's going to be really good. So with him, it's the strikeout rate, you know, as to whether he moves. He could be up in tier two for sure, and we wouldn't be surprised. He's such a good workhorse. It'll just be what kind of strikeout rate you can get from him in comparison to someone else in that tier, like a Ross or a Salazar, where we feel like we're probably going to get a K per nine of more than nine.
And then we get to five. And again, look, sorry, everybody, but if it's me, we're probably going to talk Cardinals at least some. Marcus Stroman, Michael Wacha, Jose Quintana, Carlos Martinez. Martinez is another guy I absolutely love. I have no problem seeing him at least one level up and maybe even two levels up from there by the end of the year. Are there things you worry about with him, or is it just a matter if he hasn't proved it enough yet?
Yeah, actually, there's two things I worry about. One is I'm always a little wary of pitchers who end last season, you know, with an injury or at least with a lot of fatigue, and he was one with the shoulder that didn't end last season on a high note. Now, he could be fine this year. Like, that's not my big concern. My big concern for him is his whip. And so far in his career, he's struggled to get that whip down, say, under 1.2. And with the pitching the way it is nowadays, like, if you're going to get up in, say, those top three tiers, you almost have to. I don't think there's probably anyone in those top three tiers who we have predicted for a whip of 1.2. So he's got to get down in the 1.1s to get in the top three tiers. It probably goes all the way to Tyson Ross in the middle of tier four before we see a pitcher who doesn't get his whip down into the 1.1. So that's my big thing with Martinez. Do you think that's somewhere he can go this season?
I do. I mean, again, I'm a fan. I love watching him pitch. I have a bias here. I mean, he's, you know, aside sort of selfish personal story, I literally saw the first time he threw a baseball on U.S. soil. So I kind of have an attachment to the guy. But I also just think he's a guy. Look, one of the things with starters to me, I like safe, but I also really like upside. And the further down you go, I feel like you can often, and when you get to that level, I'm more interested in ceiling than in floor, because I feel like – you can sort of play matchups and stream guys and do a lot of things to kind of fill out your rotation as the year goes on. But at that point, if I can still get a guy who might bump up and who might be really, really good, that's what I'm looking for at that point.
Yeah, now how do you see the WHIP coming down? So do you think the WHIP comes down from him having better, like developing better control and limiting his walks, or do you think he's the kind of guy who could go to like that unhittable kind of territory where he still walks a decent amount of guys, but he just gives up so few hits that he can keep a low WHIP anyways?
Well, you know, I think where it comes from, to me it comes from the hits, because the walk rate is not stupid high now. I think the walk rate comes down a little, but it's not a ludicrous walk rate now. I think if I look at one of those two things, I think I see the hits coming down. But I think it's more they kind of both come down. The guy just continues developing. And I don't think he's going to suddenly radically find Cliff Lee-esque control. But I think it's a fine adjustment there. A few fewer hits, and suddenly you're looking at the guy who's special.
Yeah, you know, you're right. And the distance from 1.25 to 1.16 or something can just be a few fewer walks and a few fewer hits. It doesn't have to be a massive jump in one or the other.
Yeah. All right, well, that's Fantasy 411 for this week. Thanks very much for taking some time here, Fred Zinke. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Let's say we do this again next week.
Yeah, absolutely. Looking forward to it already.